Heavenly Father, please help us to understand and live out your word this evening. Help us to know you better through your word. Amen. Three weeks ago, on July the 22nd, Anders Breivik from Norway planned and carried out mass murder on a small island near Oslo. According to Wikipedia, he killed 69 people on that island, mainly teenagers. He had at least an hour and a half to wander around the island by himself, and, heavily armed, he shot people as he came across them. Some tried to flee by jumping into the water and swimming to the mainland, but he stood at the shore and shot them as well, turning the water blood red. Some tried to hide, but on such a small island, it was impossible. And those who did survive told about the terror and feeling of dread as death seemed inevitable. After Anders Breivik was caught, there was widespread mourning and weeping for those people whose lives were so needlessly lost. There was also a great deal of anger. One question which must have been on many people's minds was, where was God in all of that? What was he doing? If God is in control, why did he let it happen? If God is good, what is he doing about it? Hopefully tonight may shed some light on some of those questions. Well, we've got to chapter 9 in Judges. And chapter 9 is an unusual chapter. It's violent. And you may have wondered why it's in the book at all. It is extraordinary by all accounts. First of all, we must puzzle why chapter 9 is even in the book. The chapter seems to be about Abimelech, but Abimelech is not a judge. He's the son of Gideon, who was a judge, but that doesn't make Abimelech a judge, and it certainly doesn't make him a king, which is what he spends most of the chapter trying to be. It seems that chapter 9 works a little bit like a holiday photo album. You know the way that there are two types of people who show you their holiday photos. There are the considerate ones who have 10 well-chosen photos which really capture what Cyprus was like or whatever it is. And then there are those who have 1,000 photos and sit you down with a slow turning of the pages. You are strapped to the sofa as they go over each one in detail and then go back to one that they might have missed earlier on until you drop to your knees and beg for mercy. Well, chapter 9 is a considerately short photo album from the author of Judges. It's as if he's trying to show us what Judges was like, what that time period was like in Israel, in between one judge and another, after one and before the other. We're roughly somewhere near the halfway point of the book, and this chapter shows us, like a snapshot, what life was like in Israel at the time. And the shock of chapter 9 is that instead of a photo of a beach or a sunset, what we get instead is a horror story. Something similar to what happened with Anders Breivik. And it shows how far everything has slipped into utter chaos. Now, the story presents itself to us in four scenes, four acts, if you like. These are not points, they're just things that I've put a heading on so it's easier to remember. If you're the type of person who likes taking notes, then at this point there's really not much to write. Just absorb the story and we'll retell it, relive it, so that we can see what's going on, if you can bear it. So first of all, slaughter at Shechem. This story is not for the faint-hearted. It's one of the most unpleasant accounts in the Bible, and it's by one of the most unpleasant people in the Bible, Abimelech. In fact, if nobody else has got any better suggestions, I nominate Abimelech as the most unpleasant person in Judges. Now, Abimelech was the son of Gideon, and he had 70 brothers. But he himself was different to his 70 brothers in terms of personality and also heritage. Abimelech was born from a woman who was described in chapter 8, verse 31, if you'd like to look at it. Gideon's concubine, who lived in Shechem, also bore him a son, whom he named Abimelech. Now, this concubine, probably a Canaanite concubine, in those days, a concubine would have been regarded as something like a second-rate wife. Gideon actually had many wives, but all the others were legitimate, it seems. And they named their child Abimelech, which means, "My father is king," something which obviously played on Abimelech's mind for his entire childhood, as he dreamt about the day he would become king. However, it is a false premise, because Gideon, his father, was not actually a king. He was a judge. And judges and kings are not the same thing, as we'll discover later on. Anyway, that didn't stop Abimelech from chasing after the title of being a king, and he's one of the most ambitious and treacherous people that you're likely to come across. His father was Gideon, but his mother's side of the family lived separately to the rest of them. And they lived in a place called Shechem, which is where most of the action takes place in our story tonight. So that's where Abimelech's mother and other paternal relatives lived. Orphrah, by contrast, was his father's home. Now, maybe I can show this on the map. There we go. There is a map of Israel at the time. That is Shechem. That is Orphrah. They're about 30 miles apart. And Abimelech lives down in Shechem. Now, what Abimelech does to try and get his grubby hands on the title of kingship is just incredible. He seems to think that because he's Gideon's son, he has some sort of claim on being king, even though Gideon himself wasn't a king, as we've already said. Not only that, but he sees his brothers, who were from Gideon's numerous wives, as rivals or something like that, and he sets about eliminating them. Now, this is the way he goes about it. First of all, he tells his mother and her relatives to spread a message throughout the city of Shechem, which is something like this. "Isn't it better for you to have one person ruling over you than all 70 of my brothers, especially since I'm related to you?" Now, that argument is flawed right to the core. There's no reason why any of Gideon's sons should rule after his death. You'll have noticed in Judges that when a judge dies, the normal thing is for the people to wait and cry out for another one. Abimelech seems to think that he can bypass that process and become a king. But judges and kings are not the same thing. A king rules the country and has a successor. A judge is a person chosen by God to deliver the people from a crisis at a particular time of God's choosing. Gideon was a judge, not a king. Abimelech isn't anything, but he's determined to become a king. So, he gets his mother and her relatives to spread the word that Abimelech could be king. And since they're all related in Shechem, so it seems, it would be very nice indeed if that became the king's favorite place to stay in the summer or something. So after virtually no thought at all about what they were doing, they all agreed and paid Abimelech 70 shekels of silver, one shekel of silver for each brother to be murdered. And what he does in verse 4 of our passage is he hires a bunch of thugs and he travels up the road to Orphrah at the top, about 30 miles due north. Now, the way in which he carries out this execution is truly horrific. It's not nice to relive these terrible events, but it's necessary to understand the passage later on. Just look down at verse 5. He went to his father's home in Orphrah, and on one stone murdered his 70 brothers, the sons of Jerubbaal. I wonder if that strikes you as odd. They were all killed on one stone. It's not pleasant to visualize, but the impression one gets from verse 5 is not of sort of one army slaughtering another as though there was a big battle scene, but rather the 70 sons being rounded up, restrained, and forced to wait in a queue, and then killed sequentially, one after the other, on one rock. I mean, imagine it, if you will, the rock probably about the size of a piano or something similar was where all the killing was taking place. One brother after another, screaming as they were killed. You can visualize the horror as each person was forced nearer and nearer the front of the queue, forced to watch their brothers being killed in front of them, knowing that they were next. The stench of blood, the pile of bodies. It all mounts up, and the horror of the event as each person screams and begs for their life, but to no avail. And then, just before each person was killed, the look of total confusion on their face as they see that this is no stranger doing the killing. No, it's their own brother, Abimelech. Yes, without any doubt at all, Abimelech is the nastiest person in Judges so far. But he can't count. He can't count, so it seems. He has 70 brothers, but only murders 69 of them. The little one got away, amazingly. We see in verse 5, the end of it, Jotham, maybe a little bit smaller since he was the youngest one, managed to hide himself, and he escapes with his life. Anyway, no one seems to care, and they make Abimelech king. It's slightly eerie, actually, that in Norway, the mass murderer Anders Breivik also killed 69 people. But even he didn't murder his own family. You really get an idea of just how awful Abimelech was. So that's the first point. Slaughter at Shechem. But secondly, Jotham's fable. Little Jotham escapes with his life from the slaughter, but he wastes no time and he heads straight from Ophrah back down south to Mount Gerizim in verse 7, which overlooks the city of Shechem. Now this could be really interesting. He's going straight into the lion's den, so to speak. On top of his mountain perch, he raises his voice and calls everybody to attention. In verse 7, he says, "Listen to me, citizens of Shechem, so that God may listen to you." He seems to suggest that he has their best interests at heart, if only they'll listen to him and hear him out. And what we have before us is the finest example in Scripture of a fable, beautifully crafted and delivered with great skill from just about the only goodie in our passage tonight. And he tells them this story. It sort of begins with once upon a time. You know, it almost has that sort of feel to it. You may know from the Star Wars films, they all begin with that phrase, a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. And you know that you're in for a good old yarn for a couple of hours as you put your feet up on the sofa. Well, this story has a similar feel to it. Once upon a time, the trees wanted a king. And first of all, they went to the olive tree. Very natural thing to do. It's got wonderful fruit, which is useful for baking and cooking when it goes into olive oil. And back in those days, it was also used for preserving and lubricating simple machinery. It's one of the longest living trees in the world. When I went to Israel a few years ago, they said that the trees in the Garden of Gethsemane, olive trees, were still the original ones that Christ might have prayed under. So this surely, perhaps, is a worthy king of the trees. But verse 9, the olive tree answered, "Should I give up my oil, by which both gods and men are honored, to hold sway over the trees?" Well, there's a shock. But no matter, the trees decide that next they'll go to the fig tree. And with its delicious fruit and the lovely desserts it makes, well, surely the fig tree will be a worthy successor, king of the trees. But the fig tree says, "Should I give up my fruit, good and sweet, to hold sway over the trees?" Well, then they go to the vine. The vine with its fantastic grapes that makes the most wonderful wine that is still craved today all over the world. But the vine says in verse 13, should I give up my wine, which cheers both gods and men, to hold sway over the trees? Notice that each of these worthy trees doesn't consider the office of king important enough to stop doing what they're doing and producing their wonderful fruit. But the trees want a king very badly, so then they turn to the thorn bush. Now, we've got a few thorn bushes in our garden, and there's nothing to be done with these bushes. Weed killer kills them, but leaves the prickles behind. And in the ancient world, the best way of getting rid of a thorn bush was simply to burn them. That's all a thorn bush is good for. And that was the tree that they chose as their king. Not only that, but the thorn bush is very, very proud. Just look at verse 15. The thorn bush said to the trees, if you really want me to anoint me king over you, come and take refuge in my shade. But if not, then let fire come out of the thorn bush and consume the cedars of Lebanon. Well, this thorn bush really is very proud indeed. How on earth can a thorn bush so small offer shade to trees so big? It's simply impossible. And then he says in verse 15, in effect, if there's any funny business going on, and you don't really mean to make me your king, then I'll burn you with fire. Well, it's quite amusing, really, considering what we've said about thorn bushes. If a thorn bush intends to use fire as a weapon, how will it escape being burnt itself? The thorn bush is king of nothing, but it thinks it's even the king of the mighty cedars of Lebanon, those wonderful trees in that part of the world that even King Solomon coveted a few centuries later. Now, clearly, the thorn bush is Abimelech. And Abimelech is basically king of Shechem only. It's very unlikely his power extended much beyond the local region. So what Jotham is doing as he's telling them this story is he's actually uttering a curse. He's saying, hey, boneheads, this king you've appointed for yourselves, it's a thorn bush. You've made a thorn bush your ruler. And he finishes with this shocking statement in verse 16, if you look down at verse 16. Now, if you have acted honorably and in good faith, and then he gives them a little interlude, giving them the benefit of the doubt for a little while, but he continues in verse 20. But if you have not acted honorably, let fire come out of Abimelech and consume you, citizens of Shechem and Beth Milo, and let fire come out of you, citizens of Shechem and Beth Milo, and consume Abimelech. In other words, may you both destroy each other. And before they can work out what to do with him, in verse 21, he runs away. There he goes. And the rest of the story, scenes 3 and 4, is really a fulfillment of that curse. Jotham has spoken a curse. He's uttered it on two people, Abimelech and all the citizens of Shechem. And the rest of the story is that curse being fulfilled. So thirdly, Shechem's devastation. What we get in Act 3, Shechem's devastation, is the first half of the fulfillment of the curse. Jotham cursed Abimelech and the people, and we now see Shechem's destruction. Maybe take a look at verse 26. Now Gael, son of Ebed, moved in with his brothers into Shechem, and its citizens put their confidence in him. Well, there's a new kid on the block. We don't know anything about him at all, except that he moves into the city with his whole family. And one of the first things this newcomer does is he organizes an uprising against Abimelech. Just look at verse 27. After they'd gone out into the fields and gathered the grapes and trodden them, they held a festival in the temple of their god. Goodness knows who that is. While they were eating and drinking, they cursed Abimelech. Well, there you see, the city is in uprising against their former leader. But the city commander, Zebul, in verse 30, is insulted. And he secretly sends a message to Abimelech and tells him that there's been an uprising. Abimelech presumably is somewhere else in the country, probably still back at Ophrah. So Abimelech organizes an attack on the city of Shechem, and this attack takes place over 2 days. On day one, Abimelech defeats Gaal and his family, and they're driven out. Maybe if you turn right the way over to verse 41. It says, Abimelech stayed in Arumah, and Zebul drove out Gaal and his brothers out of Shechem. So that's them dealt with. On the next day, he's told that the citizens of Shechem were out in the field, so he gets his army to hide in the fields in an ambush. Take a look at verse 42. The next day, the people of Shechem went out to the fields, and it was reported to Abimelech. So he took his men, divided them into three companies, and set an ambush. When he saw the people coming out of the city, he rose to attack them. Abimelech and the companies with him rushed forward to the position at the entrance of the city gate. Then two companies rushed upon those in the fields and struck them down. And this is the crucial verse. All that day, Abimelech pressed his attack against the city until he had captured it and killed its people. Then he destroyed the city and scattered salt over it. Well, that's just typical of his ruthlessness. Not enough to destroy the city, but to scatter salt as well, so nothing will ever grow there again. So that's the city of Shechem devastated. And the ones who escape from the initial attack don't fare much better. They barricade themselves into the city temple, and Abimelech burns it down. Take a look at the end of verse 48. He took an axe and cut off some branches, which he lifted onto his shoulders. He ordered men with him, quick, do what you've seen me do. Incidentally, that's almost word for word what Gideon, his father, said to his men. Verse 49, so all the men cut branches and followed Abimelech. They piled them against the stronghold, set it on fire over the people inside. So all the people in the tower of Shechem, about 1,000 men and women, also died. Well, this just shows Abimelech's total disregard for human life. It's interesting, though, that they were killed by fire, because that's what the thorn bush said would happen. That's Jotham's curse coming true. But we did say that if a thorn bush is going to use fire as a weapon, it ought to watch out, because it's hardly going to escape being burnt itself. And so we come to our final act, Abimelech's demise. Well, it might seem like Abimelech has escaped from the curse, but now his turn comes as well. Take a look at verse 50. Abimelech went to Thebez and besieged it and captured it. It's not entirely clear why he decided to attack this city. In fact, we don't have any clue whatsoever why he decided to attack this city. According to this map here, Thebez is, if you look at the green section about halfway up on the left-hand side, it's well within it. So it's within Israelite territory. We just don't know why he decided to attack it. But whatever the reason, Abimelech goes on the attack, and the battle scene soon sounds very familiar indeed. The inhabitants decide to lock themselves inside the city tower, bolt the door, and climb up on the roof. Abimelech rubs his hands with glee because he's seen this one before and he knows just what to do. And we're told in verse 52 that he immediately sets about trying to burn the whole place down. But this is where he gets his comeuppance. Just look at verse 52. Abimelech went to the tower and stormed it. But as he approached the entrance to the tower to set it on fire, a woman dropped an upper millstone on his head and cracked his skull. We can only marvel at why the woman had carried a millstone from her house all the way to the tower and carried it to the roof. As Abimelech's army surged into the city, we can imagine her husband screaming at her, saying, "Leave it, leave your handbag, leave the millstone, just come, run, run." And she might have replied, "No, no, you never know, it may come in handy." Puts on her shoes slowly, and sure enough, it comes in handy. It comes in handy. Because with a remarkably good shot, she gets right on his head and cracks his skull. And although he tries to sort of wiggle out of it at the end, and he sort of says, you know, to his armor bearer, run me through so that no one can say a woman killed me, it really counts for nothing. I mean, he would never be in that situation unless the woman had dropped a millstone on him. So good effort from her part, and all of his glory is robbed from him. So there we go. There's the story in all of its grisly fullness. Slaughter at Shechem, where the 69 brothers were killed. Jotham's fable of the trees. Shechem's devastation. And then Abimelech himself met his end. But what do we make of all of this? One of the things I've been amazed by looking at this passage is just how rich it is. I listened to some very good talks over the week, but one thing I could tell was the dilemma that a number of preachers had when they came to this. There's such a rich choice on things to preach on. For example, we could spend some time looking at the fact that the Israelites appointed somebody worthless to be the king of God's people, rather than somebody godly. This might be relevant at the moment, as the way in which leaders are being appointed is being revised, and there might be some mileage at looking into that. Or we could consider how strongly the people wanted somebody to rule over them in the first place, and their personal motives got right in the way. There might be a lesson in there somewhere for us as well. But the key to working out what the author is talking about in a story like this is to look for those telltale signs from the author where he explains what God is up to in the whole event. If we could find just one instance of that, then it would give us a clue as to what the passage is really about. And luckily, we get two such incidences. The first comes in verses 23 and 24, at the beginning of the third scene. Just take a look at that. Verse 23. God sent an evil spirit between Abimelech and the citizens of Shechem, who acted treacherously against Abimelech. God did this in order that the crime against Jerubbaal's 70 sons, that's Gideon's sons, might be avenged on their brother Abimelech and on the citizens of Shechem who had helped him murder his brothers. Ah, a clue. We get the final clue at the very end of our passage in verse 56. Thus God repaid the wickedness that Abimelech had done to his father by murdering his 70 brothers. God also made the men of Shechem pay for all their wickedness. The curse of Jotham, son of Jerubbaal, came upon them. Well, beware the fable of the trees, so it seems. Well, this passage, therefore, is all about God's justice. It's all about God's justice and how he made a very evil situation vaguely right again. So here are three points to think about on the way in which justice is done in chapter 9. First of all, God's justice is administered in the present. That's our first point. This came as a pleasant surprise to me to see this in effect. We often think about justice as something which will happen on the last day in the future. So on the last day, all the wickedness which has not been accounted for so far will be made right. And that's true, of course. That's true. But God also administers justice in the present. Jotham's reign of terror was cut unnaturally short. We're told in verse 22 that he only had 3 years. God didn't tolerate him for very long. Now, there's deep mystery here. Often we don't know the details behind how God does this work. In this passage alone, there's all sorts of mysterious things happening as he raises up one person against another. But at some level, justice was being done in the present. Abimelech was brought to account within his lifetime. And it's interesting, it seems today that most people are brought to justice who are criminals. Now, I realise that this is not a waterproof argument. If I say to you, Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden were both brought down, you could say to me, yes, but what about so-and-so who hasn't been? And was justice really done in the first place, and so on and so forth? I realize it's not a waterproof argument, but it does show that at some level, justice is being done in the present. And one application of this, out of many applications that we've seen already, is in Romans. So let me show you this passage in Romans 13, which makes a very similar point. Paul the Apostle is talking about the laws. Let every person be subject to the governing authorities, for there's no authority except from God, and those that exist have been instituted by God. Therefore, whoever resists the authorities resists what God has appointed, and those who resist will incur judgment. Sounds like it's future tense at the moment, doesn't it? But just wait for this. For rulers are not a terror to good conduct, but to bad. Would you have no fear of the one who is in authority? Then do what is good, and you'll receive his approval. For he is God's servant for your good. But if you do wrong, be afraid, for he does not bear the sword in vain. For he is the servant of God, an avenger who carries out God's wrath on the wrongdoer. You see, there is justice in the present by God's command. And this is a really good reason not to sin. I don't know about you, but it's sometimes quite easy as a Christian to slip into sin with the twisted way of thinking, well, because Jesus has died for my sins, therefore it's all right anyway, and I've got nothing to worry about. But we need to know that even on the last day, if there's no penalty, there will be consequences in the present. God administers justice in the present. And it's also assuring that things in the present won't get too bad. Yes, I know, things are dreadful sometimes, as this week has demonstrated. But even riots come to an end. There is some degree of justice in the present by God's command. God is in control. He was in control fulfilling Jotham's words to make sure that they came true. And he's still in control doing the same thing today. Secondly, God's justice is appropriate. The punishment fits the crime. God is fair. What we're witnessing here is the doctrine of retribution, giving people what they deserve, God's wrath against their sin. And it's worked out in this chapter with almost mathematical precision. Abimelech started a conspiracy in Shechem because he wanted to be king. But then Gaal, the newcomer, conspired against him. The leaders of Shechem set an ambush for Abimelech's men up in the mountaintops. But instead, they are caught in an ambush towards the end. The man who killed all of his relatives on one stone is killed by a single stone. The chapter shows us that God's punishment for sin fits the crime. And it's very encouraging because this is an area where human beings are notoriously bad. It's very hard to get justice right. In England these days, lots of people say that our punishments are too soft. They're not a sufficient enough deterrent. But if you go to other parts of the world and, for example, steal an apple, you may lose your hand. Now, clearly that's too harsh. Justice must lie somewhere maybe in the middle, but it's so hard to get it right. And we change our minds regularly because it's so difficult. God, on the other hand, has no difficulty getting it right. He gets it right, as this symmetrical and balanced story shows, with Abimelech being killed by a stone and the honor that he craved being stripped from him. God's justice is appropriate. Very good reason to trust him. And thirdly, finally, God's justice was concentrated and delivered in full on the cross. Now, this violent passage in Judges has shown us how God deals with sin, and therefore it brings us right to the very epicenter of the gospel, the cross of Christ, because that is where sin was finally dealt with. Please, if you would, leave Judges chapter 9 and turn in your Bibles to Romans chapter 2. someone gets there first and can shout out a page number, that might help us. Eleven twenty-nine, someone's saying. In Romans chapter 1, Paul makes clear that all of mankind has rebelled against God, and as such, they have been handed over to their sin, to wallow in it, in effect. And he concludes chapter 1 by saying in verse 29, just sort of talking about humanity in general, they have become filled with every kind of wickedness, evil, greed, and depravity. They are full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, and malice. They are gossips, slanderers, God-haters, insolent, arrogant, and boastful. They invent ways of doing evil. They disobey their parents. They are senseless, faithless, heartless, and ruthless. That sounds very much like Israel under Abimelech. It's also a good portrait of us, because we are part of humanity. And that's why he continues in chapter 2, verses 5 and 6. But because of your stubbornness and your unrepentant heart, you are storing up wrath against yourself for the day of God's wrath, when his righteous judgment will be revealed. God will give to each person according to what he has done. Notice again the fairness of God's justice. And the point of those two verses in 5 and 6 is that the rebellion will not go on forever. There will be an end to humanity's rebellion against God. Everybody, no matter who they are, both great and small, both those who are at the very lowest of society to those who are kings, even Abimelech, everyone will get what they deserve. And that's very bad news indeed. In other words, although Abimelech was partially punished for all of the wrong that he did by God in the present, he will face justice again more fully in the future. And it would be that way for all of us if it wasn't for the fact that God found another way to satisfy justice. Please turn again to Romans 3, verse 25. God presented Jesus as a sacrifice of atonement through faith in his blood. He did this to demonstrate his justice, because in his forbearance he had left the sins committed beforehand unpunished. In other words, Jesus took all the sin of those he died for in order to spare them. Now let's just take a few seconds to put this in perspective, the perspective of Judges. We've seen how God's justice was administered to Abimelech. He got what he deserved, more or less. Now multiply that by all the other people in the world who have not lived as God wanted them to live. Sure enough, not everybody is as bad as Abimelech. But some are, and some of those people have turned to Christ. So that means he definitely took their sin on his shoulders when he died on the cross. There is some debate in Christianity as to whether Jesus took the sin of everybody who ever lived, or whether he just took those who would become Christians. But at the very least, he took the sin of those who are Christians. So multiply that punishment by all the millions of Christians who have lived down the ages. All the people in England. All the people in France. All the people in America. All the people in the East. Now multiply it again by not just the people living today who profess faith, but all of those who lived down the ages. And also all of those who lived before Christ even walked on the earth. Now multiply that sin again by all the people who will live in the future across the whole face of the planet. And goodness knows how many billions that may be. And you must see that there is an awful lot of sin to deal with. Now take that colossal heap of sin, and it is colossal, and concentrate it so that it was forced upon one man, and that poor one man would have to bear the punishment of it, concentrated down to a 3-hour time period on the cross. And what you're left with is the most excruciating agony that is conceivable, as the burning hot, volcanic anger of God is poured upon Jesus with no respite. Now you can see why Jesus was so distressed in the Garden of Gethsemane before his death. And also how incredibly loving he must have been to go through with that plan, knowing how awful it would have been. Well, a very violent chapter in Judges, but it brings us to the heart of the gospel. Let's close and sing God's praises together with our final hymn.